Mr. Bangs, reel two.
Well, there's so many things that you have to learn about the everyday living in the front line. The actual fighting is only possibly 10% of it, but the rest of the time you have to eat and amuse yourselves and find a sleeping quarters. So there's so many things to learn to make yourselves comfortable. The old soldiers here are a great asset, you see, because they can, especially with somebody with some experience, and the Australians were, of course, and they certainly put me right on a lot of things, as I've explained, making fires and the best way to get by in 24 hours a day in the front line.
What was the best way to make a fire?
Well, there were several ways, but the way I was taught initially was they had what they called a chuffer stove, which was a 25-pounder shell with some holes pierced in, which you could fire holes through with your rifle, bullet holes. Make some kind of a chimney, which you could make out of various tins. I'd put them, connect them all together, make a chimney. And if you could get a little piece of brake fluid pipe and some rubber pipe, you could lead a petrol lead straight into your stove, siphon it, and make a little regulator on the rubber pipe to increase it or decrease it, and this would just drop all night. And once it was lit, you see, it would just ch, 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 and that's how they got the name of a chuffer. And it used to glow red hot, and it was a marvellous little thing. And then you had to get an ammunition box and cut it in half and make holes in it, and again, use petrol or diesel, and all these things that you picked up and learned, which made life far much easier. And they showed you how to make a bed, or if they didn't show you, certainly picked up out of machine gun belts, I think was the most popular one.
Machine gun boxes?
Belts, empty machine gun belts. And so you'd put four barbed wire pickets together and then interleave the machine gun belts, and so it formed what appeared to be like a stretcher. That was quite a popular one. And if you lined it with cardboard, well, for cardboard boxes, this made it a little bit warmer and a little bit easier to lay on. And so your first essential was to get yourself some pickets from the barbed wire, and then you was away. And then you could maybe get an empty beer box and turn it into a table. Or if you were very clever, you could turn it into a chair as well. So all little things like this, which you had to do because you were living in these little hooches, they were called.
What's a hooch?
Hoochie.
What are hooches?
These was a bunker. I believe in Malay they called them bashers, but we used to call them bunkers. They was fortified with sandbags and made shellproof.
Were there trenches in the ground?
No, you dug them out of the slip trenches. You dug out a piece of about 8 foot by 8 foot, probably 6 foot high. And I think the Americans started it, and we improved on them. And it was made with wood, basically, and then you reinforced it with sandbags on either side and across the top. And then you finish the top off with a row of rocks or bricks for a shell burst.
Which side of the trench would you build this hooch on?
Well, obviously facing away from the enemy. The only one I saw, actually, all the time I was in the front line, was on the hook, with the door facing the enemy, and a shell dropped right in there. And I lost a couple of friends that way. And so your first priority was to have it facing away from the enemy lines.
So you'd build it on the same side as the enemy?
On the same side, or, well, it was such a network of trenches, you see, on these hills. It wasn't just one particular slit trench all the way around. It was, there was a network, and so you tried to get it, if possible, out of sight of the enemy altogether. If that was impossible, then you tried to disguise it in some way, but whatever you did, you didn't put the doorway facing the enemy. That was the first priority. And you used to, these was all two men hooches, or three men, or four, sometimes even six. And so it could be very uncomfortable, so you had to make it as comfortable as you could, because you was living in them for 24 hours a day, so it was entirely up to you to square it up and make it as clean as possible. We used to line them out with cardboard, because with the trouble with these petrol stoves is that everything was black within a couple of days with the fumes of the petrol. So you try to line it out with cardboard, which stopped the dust coming down, because if you got a shell that landed anywhere near, although you were probably quite safe, it would shake your hooch a little bit, and all the dust used to come down in your food or in your beds. So you lined it out, and you put curtains across to make them warm, and just did the best you could, you know. Got quite house proud over some of them.
What did the Australians tell you about the enemy when you got there?
Not a lot that I can recall. I was on the advance party, and the first thing you had to learn was where the patrols were. That's our patrols. I was an NCO, so I knew I had to take a patrol out probably every other night. And so what I had to learn was the route to the standing patrol, and the best way to go, and where to look, and where to pay particular attention to. And then was the things that we had to learn from the Australians, which is essential when you first go in the line. You have to know the layout, and you see, Korea was a mass of hills, and so each particular hill had to be pointed out to you. Who was on your left, who was on your right, just which were the enemy lines and which weren't, and basically things like that.
What were the things that they told you to look out for in particular?
Well, they'd already sussed it out, and they knew where the... They had a rough idea where the enemy mortars were, for example. And so we knew that one particular area, say, of our particular hill, was a bit vulnerable. And so whatever happened, you didn't put your head above the slit trench there, or get out of the trench at all to let yourself be in view. Otherwise you got a couple of mortar bombs over. And the trouble with mortar bombs is that... You're the one that puts your head out or go out, you're not the one that gets killed, because a mortar bomb is not accurate to within 50 yards or so, and so it's always some other poor chap that gets it, you see, so that you've got to be very careful at certain times not to get out of the trench at all.
Did the Australians give any kind of opinion about the enemy as to how good or bad they were?
Not really. I know they called them Charlie, I believe. That was a pet name for them, and they had old slang expressions for them, which I can't really remember. But I don't remember. We didn't spend an awful lot of time with the Australians. I was only there for 2 days in the advance party, but... There seemed to be so much going on at the time that you didn't really have time to sit down and have a general chat about it. You know, things was moving all the time, so we just had no time to discuss it as such. You know. So I suppose they felt very much the same as what we did. You know, you're respecting the enemy, and there's very little you do know about them, really, especially the Chinese.
So there were Chinese, not North Koreans, facing you?
Well, we call them. We thought all the enemy was Chinese. We all spoke of them as Chinese, but we realised, of course, that that there was North Koreans as well. But for the sake of calling the enemy, then it was always the Chinese. I think the Australians or the Americans all called them the Chow, or Charlie, or Chinkies. Very rarely related them to North Koreans for some reason. It was always Chinese. And so as far as we was concerned, all the enemy were Chinese.
You said that you were only there 2 days with the Australians. What happened after that?
Well, I was on... When you go into the front line, you always send an advance party, which is a handful of NCOs, which have to go out with the whoever's occupying that particular section of the line and find out where all the patrols are and the various passwords, etc., code signs, and so. And then you're there for about 3 days, and then the rest of the battalion do the changeover. So as the Australians move out, then the Duke of Wellington's moved in. And by this time, the NCOs can go to meet them, go to meet their own particular section, lead them up the hill and take them to their particular sections where they're supposed to be, take them to their bunkers, take the rest of the corporals or the rest of the machine gunners or whatever, take them round and point things out as you've been pointed out by the Australians, you see. So that was the purpose of an advance party. So you never went up en bloc and just changed over like that. You sent a certain section up that got to know everything before the big changeover.
Presumably it could be a very dangerous time changing over if the enemy...
Yes, I think this was one of the reasons why you did it in... usually it was done at night. At one particular time, I know, we relieved the Americans. And for a week after changing over, we had to wear an American helmet. Presumably so that if the Chinese spotted you in the slit trench, they just saw your helmet and they would think the Americans were still there. And so we was always told, and it makes sense really, that it was a very vulnerable time, really, as you say, on the changeover. But nevertheless, it had to be done, you know, and it was, I think it was impractical to do it a platoon at a time, we'll say, you know, it would drag on over a period. And so I don't, as best of my knowledge, there was no particular attacks during a changeover. Whether it was because the Chinese didn't know, or what, I don't know, but it seemed to work all right.
What rank did you hold at the time?
I was a lance corporal.
And do you remember which company and platoon you were in?
Oh, yes, certainly. Number 1 section, 7th platoon, C company. Yeah, I don't think you can forget these things. Like your army number, you always remember it.
Do you know which units were on either side of the Duke of Wellington's?
Not all the time. This was something else which I think could have been improved on. We was never told. Occasionally, if you made inquiries, you could find out. I don't think they purposely kept it from you, but it was just one of these... this information that's lacking somehow in the British Army. They never get you together and get you involved in it. They just were just plonked in the line. And sometimes when you went to an O group, which was the order group, which NCOs did, you was told that a patrol from, we'll say, the Black Watch would be in such an area, and then you found out that the Black Watch was on your left. And then if you made some more inquiries, you was probably told that a company of the Canadians or whatever was on your right. But you was very much in ignorance, I found, when you went in the front line, of just who was where. In some towns, you didn't even know which particular hill was yours and which was theirs. It was as ridiculous as that sometimes, you know, because it was just a mass of hills in Korea. And so you had to do your own inquiries and own finding out, really. I don't think there was enough briefing done to put you in the complete picture about things.
Once you got settled in, what kind of work did you undertake? Just patrols?
No. It all very much depended on what particular section of the front line you was in. There was what we would call rough areas, which was pretty near to the enemy, or the relatively quiet areas, which was this Yeongdong, where we first went. During the day, you had to improve slit trenches. They may have been shelled and collapsed, so you had to dig them all out. You had a lot of wiring to do, barbed wire put down. You may have to build a couple more bunkers altogether. You may have to build a toilet somewhere. There was always something to do. Occasionally, we was in certain areas of the front line where we couldn't do anything during the day. We were supposed to sleep during the day and work during the night, as it's such a sharp area. So, but there was always something to occupy your mind, although you did seem to have a certain amount of time to yourself.
What would you do with the spare time?
Relatively very little. Again, try to improve your living quarters. That's what I always tried to do. Make yourself more comfortable. If you thought that a slit trench wasn't deep enough, you would deepen it. If you thought it was getting flooded with water, you would try and drain it away somewhere. Or, well, all kinds of things. You know, there was always something to do if you wanted, even in your leisure time. Of course, you've always got your writing home to do and what have you.
Reading books, did people do that?
Very little reading, I think, really. You know, the conditions weren't there for reading, because even in your bunkers, hooches, even in the daytime, it was relatively dark. And during the nights, you may have a candle or whatever, but you couldn't do an awful lot of reading as such. You may find yourself a little spot outside and the odd half hour, yeah, certainly, but there was very little reading done, I think.
So you weren't bored stiff?
Oh, certainly not bored. Depressed, yes, certainly. I've been depressed a lot of times, but I don't think you was bored.
What was so depressing?
The weather, I found very depressing. The monsoon season was my most depressing time. It was never dry. If you went anywhere, you had to wade through probably 2 foot of water that had settled in the slit trenches. And then when you got back, you may have a change of dry clothing. Having changed in it, you was called out again and you was wet through again. So this made you very depressed, and in certain areas you didn't get an awful lot to eat, so you was in a constant state of hunger. And plus the fact that you may have lost a friend, or a friend had got wounded, and you were hearing news of somebody else being killed or arm blown off, and you could get very depressed at certain times. I found it so. I don't think I was alone with that. You know. He was absolutely fed up and sick. Homesick, probably, I don't know.
Under these conditions of living in trenches, would you get things like they got in the First World War, they got trench foot, where your feet started to rot and this type of thing?
It was very common. We had liberal amounts of foot powder, which was told, and I think it was even an offence not to use it, foot powder. And we had foot inspections, as I recall, about 3 or 4 times a week. A foot inspection was just as common as an ordinary inspection to see if you'd been shaved or whether you were clean. You always had a foot inspection. And so I don't recall one case of trench foot, although the conditions at times was prime for it, because there was the trenches was constantly flooded in the monsoon season, and it was always wet. But I don't recall a single case of trench foot, actually.
Were there any medical conditions which people did get in the trenches?
Medical conditions? We suffered a lot of burns, which was from our various fires and that. We lost quite a few men, actually, by... not killed, of course, but severely burnt with their bunkers catching fire. It was so cold, you see, in Korea, that you just had to have a fire. Even though sometimes there was frowned upon, you know, by the officers to make a fire. You had to get warm somehow. And with no fuel, and so you had to use diesel or petrol or whatever else you could get. And naturally, this is very dangerous, playing with this stuff as far as fires are concerned.
Do you remember any serious burns?
Yes, there were several. I remember a Corporal Linfoot was very severely burnt.
Corporal what?
Linfoot. Linfoot.
How did that happen?
I'm not sure. I believe the rubber pipe that was leading the petrol to a bunker burst open and spewed petrol all over his fire, and it flared up. That's the only name I can recall, but I know there was quite a few incidents concerning fires and odd people shooting themselves or getting shot through the foot or something like that, you know. But this, I think, is general, you know, it's 1% that are always going to have accidents.
These were self-inflicted injuries?
Not self-inflicted as such deliberately, but people got so used to the weapons, constantly cleaning and loading, unloading, that... you probably got a little bit of blasé about them, and you didn't take as much consideration as what you should. And so there was a few accidents, yeah, it's true. But although not self-inflicted wounds, they deliberately shot themselves, no.
You didn't hear of people who deliberately wounded themselves to get out of it?
I heard of one when I was on this first hill, Yongdong. I don't know the lad's name, but I believe he shot himself through the foot.
Was that the National Serviceman?
As far as I recall, yes.
In your particular unit, were the majority National Servicemen or regulars?
Unit, are we talking about the company, a battalion or...?
Well, can you...
Well, it didn't make any difference, really. I would guess that 70% were National Servicemen. And the 30% was the regulars. But even the regulars, most of those was 3-year men who had signed on for the extra year, you see. There was very few old soldiers as such or regulars, apart from the say the sergeants and sergeant majors. There was probably about 1 in 10 was an old soldier or regular soldier. All the rest were National Servicemen.
Did you find much difference between the conscripts and the regulars?
In what respect? There was obviously older and a little bit more... a little wiser, streetwise. Very little difference. I got the impression that... some of the regulars didn't have a lot of time for the National Servicemen. They tended to group together, the regulars. And they appeared to be a little bit superior to the National Servicemen and sort of looked down on them, you know. In fact, invariably they used to say, if there's any argument, get some service in, which meant was you're only a 2 year man, you know. But I think if I had a choice, I would rather be with the national servicemen than some of the regulars, quite honest.
Why is that?
They seem to be a little bit streetwise, as I say, and there was experts at dodging, or skiving, as it was known then. And so the vast majority of the work was always left to the national servicemen, because the regulars was very clever and they could foresee what was going to happen and anticipate things, and they would manage to get out of the way and leave it to you, sort of thing. So there was a little bit clever in that respect at dodging the column. So I felt much happier with the national servicemen.
Did you have vermin in the trenches?
Yes, quite a lot of rats. Quite a lot. We even had snakes, but there was relatively harmless. They used to drop into slit trenches, and of course they couldn't get out. If you was frightened of a snake, I felt sorry for you, because if you was walking along a slit trench and you was confronted by a snake, some lads was petrified, you know, they didn't know what to do, they couldn't get by them. You used to finish shooting them or something like that. But there was quite a lot of rats, and was constantly warned about this particular disease which rats spread. I forget what it is now,
It's not bubonic plague.
It wasn't bubonic as such, but it was certainly a nasty disease. I believe it affected your liver.
Is this from bites or just contact with them?
I think it was contact. Yes, I think it was contact. We was always wary of rats, and there was quite a lot about. You could be in your bunker, your hoochie. And if you kept quiet, it wasn't long before you'd find a rat coming out and sniffing around for food. Again, I think we brought a lot of this on ourselves. Depending on what regiment you'd relieved in the line, if a particular regiment was not too good on the hygiene, they would leave tins of food and half tins of food and all things laying about. You had to be, you had to keep on top of it. You had to, if you had any tins of food, etc., or food, take it outside and bury it or burn it or whatever. But some places, you know, if you relieved certain American regiments, you know, those masses of empty food tins all over the place. They used to get the tins and just throw them out the bunker, sort of thing, you know, and I think this was the cause of the rats coming, and once they were there, you couldn't get rid of them. So it could have been a problem.
Did you try to get rid of them?
No, we took no steps to get rid of them, because, well, what could you do? The only thing you could do was the general, as I spoke about before, being house proud and keeping everything clean, if you was living in a place, to keep it as clean as possible. But of course, you always get some individuals that prefer to live a little bit, things being dirty. And so this was, it used to attract the rats. But if everybody kept their places clean and did what they was told, then it wouldn't have been a problem.
Would the rats just avoid you all the time?